Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Hey, daters. Are you sick of small talk and no date being planned? Well, I'm excited to introduce you to First Rounds on Me, a revolutionary dating app designed for modern singles who are fed up with the frustrations of today's dating scene. The app is all about actually helping you plan dates and build genuine connections. How so? Well, the only way you match with someone is by planning a date. Send a date, a time, and a location, and then the rest is up to you. Ready to go on real dates? You can get 1 free month of their premium subscription with code DOCTOR, D-O-C-T-O-R. Download First Rounds on Me using the link in the show notes and start building meaningful connections offline. Hello and welcome to Reimagining Love. I'm Dr. Alexandra Solomon. Relationships have the power to wound us and the power to heal us. As a clinical psychologist, author, and professor at Northwestern University, I've devoted my life to studying intimate partnerships and family dynamics. On Reimagining Love, I'm here to translate complex clinical topics into tools and takeaways that you can use in your relationships today. If you're ready to develop relational self-awareness and create vibrant and loving relationships with the people who matter most to you, you've come to the right place. I'm so glad that you're here. Thank you for being here with me today on Reimagining Love. Okay, so 2 weeks ago, I attended Esther Perel's live show in New York City. And while she was on stage, she said something like, "It seems hard to be on a first date these days without talking about open marriages and polyamory before dessert." I don't know about you, but I chuckled when I heard her statement because it feels oh so very true. You know, it's been over a quarter of a century, since The Ethical Slut by Dossie Easton and Janet Hardy was first published. So while consensual non-monogamy is certainly not a new invention, it's only been the past few years that it's truly started to come out of the shadows. And yet, in this transformation and in this transition, we've also seen how any mention of non-monogamy evokes strong reactions. Back in January, the New York Times shared an Instagram post that featured today's guest, and the comment section was packed with judgy comments, perhaps the least harsh of which were along the lines of, "Who the heck has time for that?" So what is it about non-monogamy that we find so deeply confronting? Well, today's guest, Molly Roden Winter, is not here to evangelize the lifestyle, but rather to share her story of opening up her marriage as a happily married mother and the profound lessons that she learned in doing so. Molly Roden Winter was raised in Evanston, Illinois, and she lives in Park Slope, Brooklyn, with her husband and their 2 sons. Her personal essays have appeared in The Cut, Time Magazine, Romper, and more. And now her debut book, More, a memoir of open marriage, quickly became a New York Times bestseller while sparking a public conversation about open marriages. Through sharing her journey with non-monogamy, Molly explains how her exploration of sex and relationships opened her up to the truth that love is an infinite resource. Through this journey, Molly discovered the power of more. Having more choice and more self-expression and feeling more than her roles as a mother and as a wife. Today, Molly walks us through the hows of her journey, how she and her husband opened up their relationship, and how years later they talked to their children about it. I'm very excited to share this conversation because I think Molly's journey is one that we all can learn from, no matter what relationship style we want. I love talking about non-monogamy because when we know about all the choices available to us, that makes our choices so much more powerful. I hope that you enjoy this conversation as well. Molly, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to start with the reimagining love question. But before I even get to that, I want to back up even further and just invite you to speak a little bit to the folks who are listening to this conversation, because you and I are about to have what I hope and imagine is going to be a pretty expansive conversation about sexuality and marriage and self-discovery and your journey to opening up your marriage, which is the topic of your really incredible and New York Times bestselling book, More. So I was wondering if you would maybe start with just like an invitation to the listener, like especially if these ideas and experiences feel new or challenging or particularly confronting to a listener's belief systems and experiences and sort of paradigm for intimate partnership, what guidance might you offer them in terms of like just how to listen to this conversation, how to show up here with you and with me?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing I'd like to say is that I am not proselytizing here. I'm also not even necessarily recommending open relationships to anyone. I think it's a very personal decision. I kind of started my journey without thinking that it was going to become kind of the defining aspect of our marriage. It started very much for me as an experiment, one that kind of shocked me that I was interested in the first place. So I would just say the thing that I hope and the reason I wrote the book wasn't so much about trying to convince anybody that non-monogamy is a great idea. It was more about the fact that I had learned some really valuable things about myself and about my marriage and about just being a human being, pretty much, that I felt were applicable to everyone, whether or not you're monogamous, non-monogamous, or any other relationship structure on the spectrum.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay. So that's it, right? That you are forcing nothing on anybody, but you're reporting from the trenches. I mean, which is really what your book is. It is a beautiful, thoughtful, personal report from the trenches about your experience, but you're not here to say that this is the only avenue for self-discovery.
Of course not.
And so you're inviting a kind of openness and curiosity.
Absolutely. And actually, another thing that I've been thinking about recently is if somebody was considering getting married, right, they probably wouldn't just ask one person, what is marriage like, right? And then just take their word for it and say, I guess I understand what monogamous marriages are like now. So I would say the same thing is true for my marriage, that this is one marriage, it is one non-monogamous marriage. And my hope is that my coming out of the shadows, kind of, because it has been a rather shadowy topic for quite a long time, my hope is that other people will feel comfortable offering their experiences and will start to get a sense of really the continuum that exists within non-monogamy as well as monogamy.
Okay, two things you're saying there that I think are so exciting and important. I always say that my favorite aspect of just our growing exploration of non-monogamy is just what you're saying, that it validates people who are anywhere in the spectrum, that then rather than assuming that marriage is one size fits all, I mean, which is what happens, right? We assume that any stage of commitment comes with sexual monogamy in it as a default setting. And when people, right. as we tease those apart, then people get to be really intentional about what monogamy actually looks like for them and why they're choosing it. And any choice we make with more consciousness is a choice that then we're excited to make rather than bound to make. So that's one piece that you are naming.
Can I just say yes? I just want to say yes to that because I think intentionality and conscious decision making, entering into anything you're doing in your life with the realization that you are choosing and that there is nothing that you have to just take whole cloth the way it was handed to you by a previous generation, or you can make these decisions as you go. So yes, I'm saying.
and if a couple ends up monogamous, then they're like, we are monogamous because we chose this rather than because we swallowed whole something that was the good, right, normal, only way to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the other thing I think you're saying is that your journey really began with some shock and awe, you know, that you, which we'll get into. And so what you're saying also is that by coming out of the shadows, you also are saying it doesn't have to be this way. Not that your way was, quote unquote, the wrong way, but your way really reflects how much non-monogamy has lived in the shadows, even though The Ethical Slut is not a new book. And even though communities have been exploring and developing language and frameworks for years, it's not something that was part of your awareness. And what you're saying is, you know, this is my journey. I kind of fell into this, but you don't have to. Nobody has to. We could put this out there and not be scared by it, and then decide to choose it or not choose it.
Exactly. And I think it's interesting too. It is still rather shadowy. I mean, I'm getting a lot of messages from people on my Instagram, for example, saying, even people, you know, people who are non-monogamous who are saying, I read your book, but I took the cover off because I didn't want anyone to see. Or my editor at Doubleday was telling me that the Kindle sales are so much higher than the hardcover, and that's unusual. And I think it's because nobody wants to be caught reading this book as if it's, you know, contagious. No, but it just, even showing interest in it can feel like a stigma. So my hope is that, because I think there's some really good conversations that can come out of this, even among monogamous, you know, within a monogamous couple. I know from my friends who are monogamous that my story has gotten them into some really great conversations with their spouses. So my hope is that that can spread beyond my friend group into a larger national conversation, international conversation.
So we will get to the reimagining love question because I want to ask it to you. But now we're getting something. Now I want to follow that and say, it is certainly the stigma, the sort of general stigma, but I imagine for somebody who's married, who's in a monogamous marriage, I can imagine that there's fear if that book is on my nightstand, is my spouse then thinking that I'm not the one, or that they're not satisfied, or that they aren't attracted to me? So I think that that kind of self-consciousness may be about a fear that you are going to judge me for reading it, but it also may be a sense of protection. I feel protective of my spouse because I'm reading this book. But it's not, I don't want it to be a rejection of my spouse or a denigration of our marriage up to this point. So I wonder if there's something like a fear of hurting a spouse, even just by opening the pages of this book.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. And I think there's a lot of fear for me. My book is so much about fear that I have faced. And I think fear is a really human thing. So I also don't want to say that somebody who takes the cover off of the book to read it or reads it on Kindle is, you know, hiding in a way that's wrong. I think that we don't have enough models of how to have these conversations so that we sometimes will, you know, we will make assumptions that if somebody even asks a question of their spouse, I've heard a lot of people say to me, I could not even bring this topic up with my spouse, right? And to me, that's an interesting thing because we think of our partner as someone that we can share everything with. And if they are our one and only sex partner in particular, isn't it interesting? And isn't it something that maybe we should pay attention to if something that is kind of like a sexual topic that maybe you don't even really want to pursue personally, but you just kind of want to talk about it. maybe we shouldn't have topics off the table before we've even given them a chance.
Yeah.
Just to see what's there, you know?
Yeah, I think that points to the way that we sometimes use the label of marriage as a stand-in for security. Mm. It's like it becomes the only way we define security, safety, and chosenness. And what you're saying, I think, is what if we have like lots of avenues for feeling safe and secure and chosen that also are about, it's safe enough here in this space between the two of us to talk about hard things. Like that's a different kind of safety. I think historically, marriage has just really been the only metric for like, I'm safe and you're not leaving and I'm not leaving. But there's an invitation here, an opportunity here to have safety and security and commitment really have some like deeper roots that this is safe enough to be able to tolerate a conversation that makes us both feel uncomfortable and that stretches us.
Yeah, no, absolutely. 100%.
It's what your mom said to you at some point. Wait, I gotta pull this part because I loved it. You know, you're one of the things that we will get to is your mom's history with having
yes.
a relationship that was open. And she said when she looked at you and your husband, she was sure that you guys would be fine opening up yours. She said, because you and Stuart have the two magic ingredients. You talk to each other and you love each other. If you keep doing those two things, opening yourself up to new experiences can only make your marriage richer and stronger. The two ingredients were you talk to each other and you love each other.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that is why I was more willing to take a kind of full leap into non-monogamy, because I had my mother who had also had an open marriage with my father, and they're still married for now 60 plus years. No. Almost 60.
Wow.
And,
wow.
You know, I didn't know about it as a kid. I found out when I was 28 after I was already married. But having my mother be able to say to me with confidence, right? Oh, honey, no, don't worry. This won't blow up your marriage as long as you blank, right? And so that's another, you know, important thing about having models. It's the same important thing, maybe, just to have a model in your life of someone who's been through it. It was hard, but all marriage is hard, right? And you can, sometimes you get to choose the ways in which your marriage is hard, and sometimes you don't. Hard things are going to happen in the course of a lifetime. And I feel like our marriage is stronger because of it. Could it have been stronger through other means? Of course. Time strengthens marriage as long as you keep talking to each other and keep giving each other, I think, freedom to move and grow.
Beautiful. What does that look like for you today? So this is the question that I ask all of our guests.
Okay.
How are you reimagining love in one of your important relationships today?
Yeah. So I would say non-monogamy is a huge reimagination of love. So instead of thinking about my husband and my relationship as the only intimate, loving relationship that either of us is allowed to have, we have given each other permission to have other intimate, loving relationships. And so now I feel so blessed and grateful. I have more than one strong, committed, loving relationship in my life. And my husband also has more than one strong, loving, committed relationship in his life. And as a result, one of the things that's happened is that we choose each other over and over and over again. And in a way that seems kind of paradoxical, I feel more secure in my marriage than I ever did before, even though my husband loves someone else and I love someone else, because we still love each other. And I've discovered, and it really can only be discovered experientially. So I don't think that anyone should, you know, take my word for it necessarily, but you can take examples from your own life. Anybody who loves more than one friend has had this experience, right? Sometimes you know, I taught middle school for years, and sometimes this was a hard thing among best friends in sixth grade. You know, you can think back to the time when you're best friend went away to camp and made another best friend, how that feels and how hard it is. But you can grow through it and you can work through it. Or sometimes, you know, siblings, you can think of it that way too. When suddenly there's a new baby in the house and your mom loves someone else as much as she loves you, how does that feel? Not great at first, right? For a lot of kids. So I think we have these models in our lives, and they're hard, and we know they're hard. We've just never tried to apply them to marriage. And I'm not saying everyone has to, just like I don't think everyone has to have two kids.
Right.
It's a big time commitment for one, right? To have more than one child. And I think it's just a helpful way, though, to frame it, to think about the possibility of the expansion of romantic love to more than one partner. So that's my new paradigm for loving, is that it's not a scarce resource, and I can love more than one person, and I can let my husband love more than one person, and it won't take away any love from each other. In fact, it kind of makes our life more full of love.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
My understanding from reading the book is that that was not something that you knew would happen. In fact, you just said it again, like that it was something that you only learned through experience. You wrote, it was when you were in your relationship with Scott, you said, a glimmer of an idea is forming alongside this feeling. Is it possible that my being happy with another man makes me love my husband more, not less? I can't explain how this works, but the evidence is collecting inside me. I am like a crucible where magical ingredients come together to create something new. That wasn't what you had gone seeking. One of the insights you learned along the way was that capacity for love as an infinite resource. But that I feel like what you're saying here too is it's like, it was teaching you something about you, like you were finding in that experience of love, you were finding yourself.
Yeah. I mean, the freedom that my husband gave me to pursue other relationships did teach me things about myself. And I think because he gave me that freedom, it did make me love him more. It also made me realize that he is the only one of him. Right? I might be able to love somebody else, but it's not Stuart. Stuart is a one and only. And it's funny, at one point, my husband told me, I'm not going to date people who are just like you. He's like, I have you. You are the best you, right? I don't want someone who is a Molly clone or, you know, a knockoff, right? Mm-hmm. So his current girlfriend, who he's been dating for 8 years, is different from me in a lot of ways. I've met her, we got along, but we're different, right? And I think that's great. And my current boyfriend, who I've been seeing for 3 years, is different than my husband, also has some strong similarities, but there's some key ways in which they're different. And that's part of the joy of it. So I never have to feel replaced. But again, these are some hard-earned truths that I did not come to easily. And the book is really telling the story of the 10 years it took to get to that place. And I also sometimes talk about open marriage like it's an Ironman, right? Not everybody wants to run an Ironman. It takes a lot of work, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. Can you get in shape another way? Sure. You know, will you get that runner's high differently? Very likely. But it was, this is how I learned what I needed to learn about myself and in my marriage. And I'm very happy with my choices. But again, it was hard. And I don't want to pretend like this just like happened and now we're all, you know, lovey-dovey with each other, because it was really hard for a while.
Yes. And it was iterative, right? Like, it wasn't like you and Stuart sat down and made this entire map of, okay, here's the journey we're going to go on for the next 10 years. It was a lot of fumbling and like gathering data. And okay, so if I felt that in that context, what does that mean? And how do we pivot or add a layer or refine as we go?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds a lot cleaner than it actually was. It was really messy. But like, in fact, at the beginning, I thought I was creating not a map, but more like setting up guardrails. We had a lot of rules at the beginning. And, you know, just now having told you what my reimagination of love looks like, if you had told me this was going to be the case, I would have scoffed, because at the very beginning, our chief rule was no falling in love. That was the main thing. That was what all my other rules were designed to keep that from happening, because that was terrifying to me. So the idea that I would fall in love with someone else or that my husband would fall in love with someone else was very frightening. And I came up, let's be honest, with most of the rules. Things like no playing chess with anybody but me, because that's our thing, or no sleepovers, no dating the same person twice in 1 week. I had a lot of them, right? And so it was all designed to keep love at bay. I thought it was just going to be about sex. I thought I was going to have kind of an adventure, that I needed some escape, that I was sowing some wild oats that I never sowed as a teenager because I was a very goody-goody. So I was trying really hard to protect our marriage from the effects of loving someone else, because I thought that was the thing to be feared above all other things. And it turned out that was not the thing to fear, but it wasn't easy. It was not easy at all, because love invites heartbreak. There was jealousy. There was a lot of insecurity. There was just a lot of things that people want to avoid at all costs. And it was through those hard things, though, and that's the thing about pain, that we try to avoid it, but it's actually the way we tend to learn. So if you just have an easy coasting kind of life, you don't learn quite as much as if you go through some things, in my experience. So although we were trying to protect ourselves, it was going through the hardest things that I think brought us closer to each other. But first I had to kind of discover more about myself. I needed to dig deep under some of the hard feelings in order to see what was there.
Which you didn't, my understanding is that you didn't choose non-monogamy in order to learn about yourself.
No.
Will you start by telling us like a little bit about that little origin seed of that, you know, night when you're out on your stormy, angry walk and you get kind of swept into this bar? Like, can you start us there and just tell us a little bit about that kind of original glimmer of what the heck is going on here?
Yeah. So it was 2008. At the time, my children were 3 and 6 years old. I had been a full-time teacher, but I was home for the last couple of years. I was at the end of my rope. Any mother of two kind of knows that feeling, right? Where you're just done. My husband worked a lot. He has his own company writing music for film and TV. And he had a studio in the city and often worked late. And, you know, he would have to have calls with LA at 5 p.m. LA time, which would be 8. And he would end up home after 9 most nights. And the kids were in bed and I was pissed, right? So the second he walked in the door, I said, I got to get out of here. And I just walked out. I didn't have my wallet. I didn't have my phone. Phones were kind of new then anyway. And I ran into a friend who dragged me with her to a bar, and I ended up meeting a much younger guy, much younger, 6 or 7 years. Now it doesn't feel like that big of a deal. But at the time, I just felt ancient as a mother, you know, and he was in his 20s. I was 35. And I felt this thing that I hadn't felt for a while. And it was this kind of aliveness inside me. And it was desire. It was feeling desired also. It was feeling like a whole person, like a woman, like something other than a mom with crusted cheese all over her hoodie, you know?
You said something besides the wiper of noses, the doer of dishes, the nag in residence.
Exactly. Right. I mean, that's kind of your role just changes. You just, or you become a role more than a person during those years of motherhood, I felt. And so I had a great time, came home, and my husband had seen a text on my phone because I'd left my phone from this guy. And so he was like, oh, you know, asking me questions. And it was a reminder to me as well of a conversation we had had before we got married. And we had had a couple experiences before we got married. So this wasn't entirely new. We had had a little bit of more kind of like swinger type stuff where you're doing kind of sex play with your spouse. So it's not outside of your marriage per se. It's like we had a threesome. We went to a sex club a couple times. This was in my 20s before we got married. Once we got married and I had kids, I was like shutting that down. But my husband had always said, if you want to sleep with someone else, you know, and he always said it. He said it before we got married. It had been a while since he had said it. But if I wanted to sleep with someone else, he was okay with it. In other words, it wasn't a deal breaker, but if I lied about it, that would be really upsetting to him. So I always knew in the back of my mind that if I wanted to, I could. However, I didn't think I'd ever want to. I was, first of all, I was very happily married. Sure, he pissed me off sometimes, but most of the time, we still had a good sex life. I loved my family. I didn't really have the energy for it, to be frank. And then all of a sudden, I got hit between the eyes by this desire. And my husband said, go for it. And thus began the 10 years that I'm talking about in more.
Mm-hmm. What I loved, and I think this was probably, it feels like this was maybe one of your first really important insights, was that, you know, the go for it from Stuart was also go for it and then come home and tell me about it. Like in his mind, it was going to be this feedback loop where he would get to be aroused and excited and his desire would be stoked by hearing about the experience that you had. And then for you, which made total sense to me, it was like, great, now this becomes yet another thing that I do for somebody else.
Yeah.
What you felt in that bar was your desire coming from within you. And it was like, and Stuart wasn't meaning to do this, but it was like, then your desire was co-opted because now your desire is going to be used to circle back and please your husband. So I thought that was such a brilliant and subtle insight that you shared about how you really had to, in working that layer of it, you had to really get super clear about who is this for.
Right. And that wasn't an insight that, you know, came upon me all at once. And it also didn't feel quite fair to me. I thought, well, if I'm getting permission to do this, it almost felt like, well, of course I have to bring it back to him. And what was interesting was a couple things came up over actually even just in the years since the time of the book. I wrote the book in present tense to try to keep myself from adding insights that I gained later on. Although, of course, as a writer, I'm going to do some of that. But my husband has since told me that part of it for him was also just wanting to make sure that he kind of kept up, you know, that if I was discovering something that I enjoyed sexually with somebody else, he wanted to know about it so we could do it too, right? But sometimes it didn't actually work out that way. Sometimes it was like only something I wanted to do in one situation, or it was something I was curious about, but I didn't want it as part of the daily repertoire, you know? But a lot of that discovery came over time.
But there's something like so about that, like razor's edge, especially for a mom as she's raising her kids, where anything's on a razor's edge to become another duty or obligation. So it just makes so much sense to me that you were very sensitive to something being yours, you know, something about being the doer of dishes, something about being the wiper of noses, something about the fact that you've got people scrolling through your brain all the time, that the sparking of your desire in the bar felt like you and yours, and you were particularly sensitive to having it becoming stewards.
No, that's absolutely true. And I'm glad that you picked up on that nuance in the book, because I feel like part of how some couples, and I'm not saying this is wrong, I'm just saying it wasn't going to work for me. A lot of couples pursue non-monogamy together. And swinging is a form of non-monogamy where you're doing, you know, sex parties together or doing things more just as a couple. And that was never going to work for me. For one, it was because I have no interest in seeing my husband with another woman. I don't want to hear the details. Quite to the contrary, they're upsetting to me to this day. But I've gotten better about being clear about the questions I ask and where I would like more information and where I would like that information to stop. But I also absolutely felt like the thing that was most titillating for me in some way was the freedom. The idea that I'm a person, I am a whole person who gets to make my own choices and decisions, and I'm not answering to anybody right now. And that's kind of a false freedom in some ways, because I wrote about this at one point too. There's a great line of Rachel Cusk, a writer who I love, who said, you know, she's writing about motherhood, and she says, when you're with your children, they are with you. And when you are not with your children, they are with you.
They are with you.
Yeah, I might be messing that quote up just a bit, but it's that idea that it's so hard to not have your children on your mind. And I'm just starting to enter. My kids are now 19 and almost 22. And I'm still like, oh, I have to make sure, you know, my youngest, it's his first day at a new job tomorrow. And I just want to make sure I check in and find out how it was, or want to make sure that he got his prescription refilled, or I just, you know, grilled my oldest about whether or not he's needs to go to the ear doctor if everything, you know, he's had ear tubes throughout his life. You know, mm-hmm, it's just this constant kind of worry that I have found now a way to integrate it with my whole self. It used to feel very much at cross purposes with being a whole person. And this is, I think, one of maybe my main messages of more that, and that's kind of one of the meanings I feel of more in the title, that you can be more than a mother. You can be more than a wife. It doesn't have to take a form of non-monogamy in order to get there. But for me, I had to find ways to explore my own self outside of the role of wife and the role of mother.
Right. This isn't the only way, but I think it's no coincidence that the quote that you use that opens the entire book is an Audre Lorde quote that I just love. The erotic is the nurturer of all our deepest knowledge. So there is something, and I think this is for every listener to kind of play with for themselves about what happens when you honor, tune into, and follow your erotic as a source of knowledge about you. And that can be separate and apart from any choice you make around sexual boundaries in your life. But that it is, right, that was the feedback loop that perhaps you didn't maybe know what happened as you started this, is that these experiences would take you back to you, and these experiences would teach you about you through this journey. Right, you learned more about being more than the roles that you take on. Roles that mean the world to you. Roles that matter
sure,
to you. Roles
yes.
that you're saying, right, even with young adult kids,
yeah.
you still are playing because they matter and they are an expression of love. They just are not the sum total of you.
Yeah, no, and I love that. It's a good reminder, because sometimes I feel like I'm also trying to soften my message because I don't want to make anybody feel like I'm trying to force anything on them. But it is true that sex and sexuality is one of those aspects of our deepest selves that it doesn't actually serve anyone to repress, in my opinion. Ooh. That when we repress ourselves sexually, we're cutting some really important knowledge source off. And it's part of us. it's not, in my opinion, not just for procreation. There is incredible pleasure that can come through sex that is something to pay attention to. And there's also this potential for connection, right? So some people would say, I've had questions such as, why wouldn't you just get divorced if you want to have sex with other men? Mm-hmm. So that's not the point at all. Like, I still have a deep sexual intimate connection with my husband, and I have sexual intimate connections with other men. And it's partly through the sex that intimacy is built sometimes. And it's not the only way we can build intimacy, but it is a way to build connection, and it's a way to build connection with yourself when you really explore it fully.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
I think the reason, I think part of the reason that, I think there are many reasons why your book became a New York Times bestseller. It is so well written. It reads like fiction. So you're just like, okay, what's Molly doing next? And what's she going to take from it? You know, we have lots of windows into your relationship with this therapist who was like such an ally and support and witness to your journey. So there's just, you take us through a beautiful experience. But I think it's also something about how you come in as a cis straight woman in a cis straight marriage who's a mother. So I think there's something that, that is particularly intriguing about that. So I would love to talk a little bit about your relationship with your sons and read to you, you know, this is how you open the book, is with Daniel, one of your sons, being like, are you and Dad in an open marriage? And when he asks you that question, you write, my brain floods with the myriad ways in which awareness of his mother's sexuality might damage a boy forever. And then I exhale. There comes a time when what you feared simply happens. I have dreaded this moment for 7 years or maybe longer. Maybe I've dreaded it ever since Daniel was born, and I realized that my child would one day grow up and see me with a critical eye, who would know who I really am. But such a thing never happens in just a day. Falling from grace can take a while.
Yeah.
So tell us what happened when the moment you feared simply happened, and how the conversations have developed over time with your sons.
Yeah. I mean, the fear really arose in many ways just from shame. I felt ashamed of my sexuality. And I felt ashamed that my son knew that I was a sexual person. I have a funny story from when, you know, that scene happened when he was 13, when he was about 7 and he found out about how babies were made. He looked at me and he said, Mom, you did that? And then he added, twice? Oh. And so I was like, and at that time I was like, yep, I did it twice, you know, because mm-hmm. I did not want to go any further than mm-hmm. that. But there is this thing about, oh my God, my son knows I had sex, right? Of course I had sex. I am a mother. however, there is something about breaking that kind of barrier. And I don't mean in terms of taking away all boundaries. New York Magazine recently had a whole issue about polyamory, and I wrote the piece about talking to your kids about it, because not that many people have the experience that I've had of my kids now being adults and my having to have, you know, kind of navigated this from the time they were a young age. But I think there is a way to talk to your kids about sex that keeps the boundaries intact, right? They don't need to know everything I'm doing. They shouldn't, right? And they also, it's kind of the same way as when you are in a monogamous marriage, you don't necessarily announce to your kids, hey guys, we're going to go upstairs and have sex. So make sure you turn up the TV. Like, I mean, you could, but that's, everybody would be very uncomfortable with that, right? So I feel like there is a space for privacy, and we did use the word private. I eventually got better at talking with them, and we would talk about things that were private. But I learned to deal with my own shame around it so that I don't have shame anymore. And that allows them to not feel shame about themselves or their own sexuality or things that they do in life that are maybe things that other mothers would freak out about, right? I feel very lucky that they both do talk to me, one more than the other, but that's okay.
That's always different happens. Kids.
It's always the way, right? Mm-hmm, the one I have to dig for information and the other one tells me every thought he's ever had.
I have that too.
Yeah, isn't it funny? Uh-huh. My sister does too with her two sons. So I do, though, feel like they know that I'm not going to be shocked by things that they want to talk about. They know that I am a safe, sane, stable person in their lives. I have kept, you know, the people that I date outside of our marriage to the sidelines until very recently. My oldest, who's almost 22, met my current boyfriend at my birthday party, and that felt appropriate. I asked him in advance if that would be okay, and he said yes, and then he surprised me by inviting his girlfriend, who I had never met, and then I met her too, so that was lovely. Aww. And my husband was there, and he knew that everything was kosher, everything was fine, but I wasn't interested in doing that with them when they were 13 or 14. Now, there are other people who have more kind of united polyamorous lifestyles where there might be more than two parents involved or people are living together. And there's so many different ways that it can look. And I think as long as you're keeping, you know, love and what your kids need in terms of stability in place as best you can, I mean, we also know that divorce can be destabilizing for kids. There are a lot of things that can be destabilizing for kids. We can't always have the kind of cookie cutter life that gets promoted as the only way to keep our kids safe and sane. I think the important thing is to talk with them through it and to let them know you love them and to let them know through time. And that's really what it takes. Over time, my kids saw that our marriage was strong, that neither of us were going anywhere. They see us still being affectionate with each other. They know we tell each other the truth, and it's taken away a lot of the anxiety around it. But there was some anxiety for both of them for some time.
Everything you just said, I think, also has the power to become a template for blended families as well. Like just that, you know, the expansive way that you're talking about love, and that there are different boundaries. It's not a free-for-all, and there's discernment about what's private. But there's something about, like, that, again, the idea of more being something I think would really serve. I think the most difficult thing of being a kid of divorce is that deep sense of loyalty bind and this awareness that these two people can't be in the same room, and I have to have this part of the family and not that part of the family at the sporting event, or all of that kind of division. There's something about, I think, as is always the case, that there's so much to be learned from communities that have been previously marginalized, that as we listen and tune in and look at other ways that other family systems are doing things, there's so much to be learned for a blended family around just that inclusivity and more and broader definition of what it means to belong.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's no one right way to do it. You know, it kind of has to do with your own comfort level too. I really have no interest in having a relationship also with other people's children, right? So if I'm dating someone who has younger children, and that came up at the end of More, somebody I was dating who was going through a divorce and really wanted me to meet his son, it didn't feel right. I thought, no, that's too confusing for him. And I didn't know what the longevity of our relationship was going to be. And it just felt really misguided to do that. So I, you know, with the help of my therapist also, I kind of tested the waters with my therapist and decided, no, that's not a good idea. I'm not going to meet your kid. But another person might want to meet a child. And it kind of depends on a lot of different factors. So there's, you know, there's no one right or wrong way. It's just kind of, again, about being conscious and about thinking through why you're doing what you're doing. And if you're trying to meet each other's kids in order to cement a bond, that's not a great idea, in my opinion. I think bonds have to be cemented without the kids having to get too involved, and then they can be brought in once the bonds are clear and strong.
And the relationships, right, the relationship structure.
Right, that's what I mean, there. Yeah.
So what do you think, what does our collective heightened public discourse about polyamory, which really has only been the last, I don't know, 5-ish years. Mm-hmm. What does this increasing conversation about polyamory tell us about this moment in our culture? Like, why now? And what do you think this is pointing us towards?
Yeah, well, it's just I have theories. So I am just one person with my own theories. But I think part of it has to do with we're breaking down some of the binary thinking in our culture. In other ways, I think people are doubling down on binary thinking. You know, you look at gender, for example, my children as members of Gen Z both have, and, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, it helps too, where there's just more acceptance about people who are non-binary, but both of them have close friends who are either trans or non-binary. And it's just part of the lexicon for them to talk about pronouns and to have no issue. Whereas I'm getting there and my father has a lot of trouble because it just doesn't make sense to him, right? But I think younger people are also thinking that we can be broader minded about things like marriage, right? That marriage doesn't have to be this one particular way, that we can open up some of the spectrum that's possible of, you know, especially I think as gender opens up, non-monogamy has been practiced in queer communities for yes. You know, or been more accepted in its practice, because oftentimes if there is a bisexual partner who does not feel, you know, kind of complete with just one gendered partner, that can be an issue. Or if you're in a gay relationship, I've talked to gay friends of mine, gay men, they don't have the kind of heterosexual gender roles that we apply to marriage kind of as a default. And so everything's a negotiation, and monogamy becomes a negotiation too. So there's nothing that they kind of take for granted as this is the way marriage is going to be, because this is the way our parents did it, right? Their parents didn't do it necessarily. And so they're negotiating. So I think there is some of that. And I think it's just starting to bleed into the rest of the culture now. It's not just in queer communities or just on people under 30. And I thought I also had kind of a unique perspective, my parents having had an open marriage in the 70s. Mm-hmm. I'm having an open marriage, you know, as a 51-year-old, and it started when I was about 35. But I think when I talk to people who are younger, they don't really bat an eye. It's kind of the Gen Xers and older who are still grappling with some of this, which we didn't think these were choices. We thought this No. was the default. And so to be told that something you thought was not a choice actually is a choice can shake people's foundation a bit. But I think it's a very easy conversation for people who have grown up around the new thoughts about gender.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. We're asking big, important questions about all of the institutions that have been handed to us, you know, and asking, yeah. Okay, on what principles was that institution built, and who does it serve, and who does it leave out, and what are the risks, and what are the benefits? And so I think it is, right, it's really exciting that we're asking those same questions about marriage and monogamy as things that really truly were institutions. Like you said, growing up as a Gen X also, I didn't see it as a choice on the menu, you know, that it
No.
was, it was not even available. And so I think that I teach at Northwestern, and it's really exciting that for the students there, many, 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 many of them are interested in monogamy and are choosing that, but they're choosing it from a place with much more awareness than I do. Or they are opting out of monogamy for now because of semester abroad and, you know, long distance and hookup culture. And so they, you know, and so it may not become kind of like a long-term, more soul level or self level choice. But I love the ways that they reach for that as almost like a solution to a very real, like, developmental challenge that they're grappling with.
Right. Because, like, what if you fall in love when you're 20, but you want to go do something else that's going to, and your short-term goals and your partner's short-term goals are different. Is it possible to pursue those short-term goals and open yourself up to new experiences and then return to each other without feeling like it's a betrayal? Yes. Feeling like this was a conscious choice, the loving choice to make for both of you, you know? Yes, it's possible.
Absolutely. Right. Right. Because previously the definition had been, if you do that, it is wrong and you have to heal from it.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's chosen, like, this makes sense for us and we have enough faith in each other and we have enough kind of like depth of connection that we'll actually, it's still an act of a leap of faith, but we trust that we can maybe come back around after these experiences and reconnect with each other and that the connection will be potentially even deeper or built on something even more sturdy.
Right, exactly. And if you don't let yourself do those things, then what are you thwarting, right? What is the opportunity cost there? And it's not just about the other relationships you can have. It's about giving each other, as I said, just freedom to become your fullest, most fulfilled self.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that you shared as much as you did about your therapy journey. And it's like, it feels like the arrow went in both directions, that your experiences in non-monogamy helped you more deeply understand the parts of you that needed tending and healing. Mm-hmm. And that as you tended and healed to those parts of you, you were able to be more mindful, intentional, relationally self-aware, as I would say it, in your non-monogamy choices. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, that's a great way of putting it. So therapy was a crucial piece of this journey for me. And it's interesting, you know, there's an early scene. I go to the therapist once, and then he's really trying to get me to think about what will this mean for you, right? This is when I've met the younger guy and I'm thinking about sleeping with him. And he's asking, what will this mean for you? And I don't want to think about it. Mm-mm. So I cancel therapy, right?
So classic move.
I know how to fix this problem. I'll just stop going to therapy. And then I eventually went back. But I was afraid of being talked out of something that I wanted to do and I didn't want to look at it too deeply. So I think part of me knew there's something here, right? There's something underneath this that you don't want to look at. But it was still there. A year later, I can't remember how long my hiatus from therapy was, but yeah, and therapy became a very important tool for me in terms of understanding why I was doing what I was doing. And he wasn't trying to stop me or encourage me, which I think is the mark of a good therapist. He just wanted me to think about how to frame it to myself and how to better understand why I had this impulse in the first place, where it was all coming from. And it was all so helpful.
Oh, yeah. I just am really grateful for this conversation. I think that you have written something that is important and challenging. And it just was such an engaging read. And it was fun to read knowing that I was going to get to meet you. But I think even for readers who won't get to meet you and kind of, you know, just bear witness to your story face to face in this way, it is such a wonderful, thought-provoking book. So thank you so much for creating it and sharing yourself with us in this way.
Thank you so much. You had such wonderful, thoughtful questions too. I feel like I learned some new things about the book as I was talking to you. So thank you.
Oh, that's great. Okay. So we know that the book is available wherever books are sold. In the show notes, people will be able to find more, a memoir about open marriage, but we're going to send people to bookshop.org because that supports the indie booksellers.
Great. Yes. I'm a big believer in independent bookstores. So I like that.
And then what else? How else can people get in touch with you and get to know your work more deeply?
Sure. Well, if you go to my website, which is mollyrodenwinter.com, you will find I do a Substack newsletter, which I've been doing just every couple of weeks, especially on this journey of publication. It's my first book, and it's kind of thrust me into the public eye in a way that has been very interesting. So I've been writing about that experience. And I also am on Instagram, mostly on Instagram, but also some on Twitter, a little TikTok even, which is crazy, but true.
Hey, hey.
And all my social media links are on my website as well. So that's like a good one-stop shopping. And I post my events there as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Molly.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Molly, for joining me here on Reimagining Love. If you want to read more, A Memoir of Open Marriage, please visit the link in the show notes. As always, feedback is my love language. Please consider leaving the show a review on your podcast platform of choice. And you can always share your comments or your thoughts on this episode with me by emailing me at info@dralexandrasolomon.com. Until next time, be well. Reimagining Love is produced and edited by Emily Reeves. Our theme music was composed by Slade Warnkin. Do you have a relationship question that you want answered on the show? Visit reimagininglove.com to send in a written or audio question. Questions can be about intimate partnerships, family relationships, friendships, you name it. If you're looking for more love and relationship content, you can find me on Instagram at dr.alexandra.solomon or visit my website, dralexandrasolomon.com, where you'll find my blog as well as the Intimate Relationships 101 e-course based off of the popular class I teach at Northwestern University. Thank you for listening and see you next week here on Reimagining Love.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.